Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about the Civil War, and we have been focusing on a few of the military-related people, especially in the North during that war. And even though this seems a little unrelated to the general topic of Black America, we believe it's important to briefly discuss what all that happened during the Civil War reveals about the U.S. military. And we're going to talk a little bit about the underlying problem or root issue that's in the American military that has been there, I guess, in a sense, from the beginning, and is still there now. And it's important to root it out and to deal with it. And it's also important to mention it in the context of all that we're talking about, because there is, as you shall hopefully see, there is a connection between slavery and this root issue. So let's do a brief recap of some of the people we have talked about that are related to the military, so that we can then go ahead and talk about the root problem. We talked briefly about John Fremont, and he was an important person. As I've shared before, I personally believe that he is one of the top 20 greatest Americans of all time. That's how important he is, even though historically people haven't really given him the honor that he deserves. He was the first Republican candidate for president in 1856. First it was Fremont, and then in 1860 it was Lincoln. But people forget John Fremont was the one who kind of inaugurated the Republican Party and the opposition to the Democrat Party and to slavery and to every bad thing the Democrat Party stands for. And also he was very important in the pioneering of the West, and to the point that he eventually became a senator. He was one of the first two senators that California ever had. When California entered the Union in 1850, and they were given two seats in the Senate, just like any other state, one of those seats was occupied by John Fremont. He was elected as senator for California, and he did a lot of work, pioneering work. That was helpful in the spreading of America westward, all the way to California. And now the and he was also very successful militarily, and that's why he was given a position of leadership in the state of Missouri by Lincoln when the Civil War started. And we mentioned briefly that when he was there, he issued he was a man of action. He was the opposite of Lincoln, the opposite of all the other people around him, and he knew there was an enemy to defeat, an evil to destroy, and he was fighting the system to that was preventing him or that was not equipping him to carry out that mission of destroying the enemy and having victory. And that's why he kept trying to get Washington, Lincoln in Washington, to help him with troops and things like that, because he knew that he needed these things, certain things, to get the job done. It wasn't him just sitting there thinking, okay, well, I'll just wait for things to come to me because I'm a soldier, and as a military member, I am under this authority, and I don't do anything unless I'm told, If I'm not told to do something, then it's not my problem. It's the problem of the people above me if it's supposed to be done. He didn't take that attitude. It's like, no, there is an evil that we're facing that we have to destroy. And if we're fighting a war and we're supposed to win it. I mean, that's what you go into a war for. You don't go to lose. You go to win, just like in anything. One of the things he did while he was governor is that half of Missouri was occupied by the South, by the Confederates, and they were putting up a strong opposition. And on top of that, you had the sons of bitches in Missouri who were slave owners, who were sympathetic to the South and were kind of sabotaging things and collaborating with the South against the North. And this was hindering the work of the Union Army in Missouri and hindering the work of John Fremont. So John Fremont, who was also very strongly anti-slavery, and he pushed that you could say cause as he pioneered westward. And California entered the Union as a free state, and he was part of that Western spirit that was heading westward, and as it did, hated slavery all the way, and so he was anti-slavery, and so that's why he was committed to winning the war. He wanted to defeat the South. Because he wanted to defeat the evil that the South was harboring, which was slavery. And as he saw that things were not going well, he knew that he could do certain things to have the victory. One of the things that he did was to issue two emancipation kind of proclamations, in the sense, in Missouri. Kind of declaring officially that if you work with the South, we're going to confiscate your property, and your property, by your own definition, includes your slaves, and therefore we're going to take those slaves and set them free. And we're not only going to set them free, we're going to arm them and have them join the army so that they can help us defeat you. And he issued it as a proclamation at the Missouri level, in the area that he supervised. And Lincoln heard about this, and they complained to him. The Southerners, the people in Missouri complained to Lincoln in Washington. They sent letters and so forth to tell him to stop Fremont, and Lincoln was horrified. And he told Fremont to stop it. And Fremont said, no, I'm not going to do that because you're not helping me here. You're not helping me with the supplies I need. You're not helping me with the military strategizing that I need to do, etc. And he said no. And that's why he was deposed. He was, let go. And replace with someone else, the person, and we'll talk about that other person later. But the thing is that, and this is so hypocritical because Lincoln eventually, 2 years later, or less than 2 years later, issued the Emancipation Proclamation, an emancipation of his own, and that was the turning point in the Civil War, not only. Morally, but also militarily, and I think we've already mentioned why a little bit. So the thing is that here we see a man who was a very good general, a very good soldier, but he was a man of principle, and his principle went above his desire to just be a cog in this machinery of an army. He was not just a soldier following instructions and just doing what he was told and just limiting his thinking to that. And if it's not an order, he's not going to worry about it. And if he thinks that something should be done, but it's not being ordered to him, then it's not his problem. It's the problem of the people above him. He didn't have that thinking, and that's why he was let go. But ironically, his thinking was what eventually changed the war to the North's favor later on. So we briefly talked about him. Another person we talked about was Winfield Scott, who was the first leader or chief officer, whatever you call it, the title is, of the Union Army at the start of the Civil War. And we did briefly talk about him, but let's say a few more things that we had not mentioned before about Winfield Scott. He actually is one of the kind of more prominent people in American history, more prominent than most people realize. I wouldn't put him in the top 20 or 30 of all time for reasons that I guess hopefully will become clear, but he was a very important person in some aspects, his positive aspects, he was a very good person. And in fact, he actually ran for president in 1852. He was the Whig Party nominee. You know, in those days, there was the Whig Party and the Democrats before the Republicans came along. And he ran for president in 1852, but lost to a worthless son of a bitch called Franklin Pierce from the Democrat Party. And we have talked about that son of a bitch in a previous audio snippet, a worthless idiot. But let's not talk about him. What I mean to say here is that he should have won the 1852 election if Americans had not been stupid the way, you know, we tend to be. If we had voted for the right person, then Winfield Scott would have been a more recognized name because he would have been president of the United States in 1852 instead of this worthless bastard, Franklin Pierce. Now this Winfield Scott not only came close to being president of the United States, but also he was in the army from 1814 to 1861, and yes, you heard correctly, 1814, not 1840, 1814. So 2 years after the War of 1812, this guy joined the army. And he was there until 1861 at the start of the Civil War. He resigned for reasons that I think we have briefly described before, but he was the leader of the Union Army at the start of the war. When Lincoln was inaugurated into the White House, he was the top army person or military person in the U.S. This man had a big career. He was a man of great military etiquette, you know, that the sort of person who likes to follow procedures, follow rules, very, you know, very straight soldier, you could say. And that's why he was nicknamed Old Fuss and Feathers. So you can get a sense of the personality that he was. He was like, okay, let's follow procedure. Let's do follow the protocol, and so forth. And because he was in the army for so long, and I believe he was the person with the longest career in American history or something to that effect, he has records. And he was also the person who held the position of chief officer of the military for the longest time, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, this guy is a big figure in American military history. And that's why he was also called the Grand Old Man of the Army, you know, in honor of him being so long, you know, in the military. And he was very important in the Mexican-American War, and to the point that Robert E. Lee, who later became the traitor who served the South to defend slavery and Southern state rights and federalism and all that stuff, Robert E. Lee, who was in the Army, fighting in the Mexican-American War, obviously for America, he is quoted to as saying that America's success and his success in the Mexican-American War had to be attributed to Winfield Scott, and he called him our leader. So clearly Robert E. Lee, who was a good strategist, he was, as a human being, he showed what he really was when he joined the South. But at least from the military perspective, he was relatively, quote, brilliant, if that's the right word to use there. And even he acknowledges Winfield Scott's brilliance and military importance in the Mexican-American War. So he was this very successful, important person who had great victories. He, in fact, the Duke of Wellington, you know, the guy from Waterloo, the Battle of Waterloo, the guy who was who helped defeat Napoleon, and also the guy who was most people don't know this, but this Duke of Wellington was also Prime Minister of the UK twice. So this is a very important figure in British history, called Winfield Scott, quote, the greatest living general. And he called him that after Winfield Scott's capture of Mexico City during the Mexican-American War. So this guy had a reputation even all the way to the UK. And imagine the Duke of Wellington, the guy who defeated, helped one of the two, or I believe, generals who helped defeat Napoleon in Waterloo, called Winfield Scott the greatest living general. So that's the kind of caliber of person that we, of military person we're talking about here. And sad that most of us in America don't know who he is and wouldn't recognize his name if it was said to us on the street. So that's how relevant he was. Now, as we said before, he was the leader of the army, of the military, for a long time, including the period he served under Pierce, the guy who defeated him in the 1852 election, but he had a lot of conflict with him. And he had a lot of conflict also with the Secretary of War that Franklin Pierce chose, who happened to be Jefferson Davis, the son of a bitch who became the president of the Confederacy during the Civil War. So that tells you what kind of person Pierce was, that he had Jefferson Davis as his Secretary of War, and Winfield Scott didn't get along with Jefferson Davis, so he had a lot of conflicts with him. But he stayed under Pierce, and then came Buchanan, the next guy in 1856, who won the election after Pierce, and he had a lot of, he was very critical of Buchanan, James Buchanan, because of his inaction when South Carolina seceded and when the southern states started seceding after Lincoln had been elected, and before he took office. And Buchanan just remained kind of passive, and Winfield Scott became very critical and had a lot of conflict with Buchanan because of his passivity, and he was hoping that Lincoln would be the change of pace that he was looking for. But Lincoln kind of disappointed him in his inauguration speech. When Winfield Scott heard the speech, he realized, oh, I guess things are not going to change as much as I thought they were going to, because this guy is an appeaser just like Buchanan. But he stayed around, and Lincoln was concerned before the inauguration, thinking that because Winfield Scott was from Virginia and, you know, from the South, that he might not sympathize with Lincoln. And he sent people to ask him, are you going to be loyal or help me? And are you going to even, like, have the army protect me during the inauguration, because there were threats on his life and so forth? And Winfield Scott said, you know, I'm a soldier, and my job is to protect the commander-in-chief, so don't you worry, I will do my part, and he did. You know, he was supportive of Lincoln as a soldier because he saw it as his duty. He was a man of great military etiquette, and he thought it the proper thing to do as a military person, and that's why he stuck with the Union Army. He didn't side with the South, and he protected Lincoln at the start of the war. And he was not a man concerned about slavery per se. He was concerned about the Union, just like a lot of people who were not in the Civil War to end slavery, but to preserve the Union, preserve a Union that was already dead. We explained this before, but in their heads, they were saving something that was on the verge of being lost when in fact it had been lost already. The thing is that that's kind of the mindset. And it's important to describe that mindset because there is an underlying problem in there. Even though this guy was not overtly evil or anything of the sort. But just to give a sense of where his mind was when he left, because he left as Lincoln started to marginalize him. And he said, I'm old and I can't take much of this anymore. And so he just said, okay, I quit. And before quitting, he recommended a man called Henry Halleck that we talked about before, who was born in New York, a Northerner. He named Henry Halleck as his successor. But the thing is, so you can understand where Winfield Scott's mind was, is that at the start of the war, Halleck, this Henry Halleck, who was from New York, even so sympathized with the South. He believed that the federal government didn't have authority over the states. Doesn't that sound familiar? And that therefore slavery was not an issue to be dealt with from the federal side because that's not in the Constitution. The federal government is not constitutionally empowered to force the South to give up slavery. Doesn't that all sound familiar, conservative out there? Well, that's exactly how Henry Halleck was thinking. And he said, we shouldn't be trying to force the South. They are sovereign states and they have the right to do what they want. And so he sympathized with the South, but he didn't, you know, join the Southern Army or secede or whatever, because he did believe in the value of the Union. Again, he stayed with the Union in the military, fighting the South, even though he agreed with the South's position, because he thought it was more important to have, you know, the united country preserve the United States than to have it divided. So that tells you, the fact that Winfield Scott chose him as his successor tells you that he was never thinking in terms of principles of really like this is right, this is wrong. He was thinking more from a military perspective. He saw Henry Halleck as a talented military person, but he didn't see that inside of him was a man who really didn't believe in the cause that was being fought for. And the cause was more than just keeping the country together. There was something else beyond that, and he didn't see that. And that's why he chose or selected Henry Halleck. Henry Halleck was not the person Lincoln selected. Lincoln selected an even worse person, eventually called McClellan, that we'll talk about in a short while. But the thing is that Winfield Scott, who was a good person, a good general, and so forth, was always seeing things from a military perspective and a patriotic perspective. And doesn't this sound familiar, conservative? You know, think about the country, I've sworn my loyalty to the United States of America, and America is being divided, and I'm loyal to America, and therefore I'm going to fight to keep America stitched together in this dysfunctional unity that we have had. I'm going to fight to preserve that dysfunctional unity, and that was his goal. And he saw everything from that perspective. And that's why to him, Henry Halleck was a good option. He was a good military person from a military perspective. And even though he sympathized with the South and believed all these things, that's, you know, that's not our problem. We don't worry about that. You know, that's and that's, I hope you're beginning to see that's part of the problem we're going to be addressing. This constant obsession with, it's not my problem. I just do what I'm told. I have a mission and I have sworn loyalty to this mission and that's all I care about. And if there's something going on that I don't agree with, you know, I'm just going to swallow it and it's not my problem at the end. Even though this guy did fight with his superiors about many things, you know, just like he fought with Jefferson Davis, the Secretary of War during the Pierce period, Franklin Pierce period, and he also was in disagreement with Buchanan about things he was doing and so forth. So he had this conflict. He knew that, and that's what happens when you are when you have a prince when you have a cause inside of you, and the people above you are not in agreement, and they are kind of doing things that are defeating that cause that you are. Fight and that you believe in on the inside, you will get upset and you will fuss and cause a turmoil, and that's what John Fremont was doing. But Winfield Scott would only do the fussing up to a certain point, ironically, because he, even though his nickname was Old Fuss and Feathers, he would only make a fuss. Up until a certain point, but he would make a big fuss about things that had to do with military etiquette. There he was very fussy, but he was not that fussy when it came to certain principles. Now let's talk about Henry Halleck. He was the person who replaced Fremont. All these people are interrelated, you could say, who replaced Fremont in Missouri when Fremont was let go by Lincoln. Because of his audacity to proclaim this emancipation of slaves in the South, in Missouri, you know, he put in Henry Halleck instead of there in Missouri, and he and Henry Halleck was a very cautious general, and you know, he was you know, a guy who said, okay, you know, let's follow the rules and let's not take too many risks, and that's kind of his mindset. And because of that, he butted heads a lot with his most famous subordinate, who happened to be another guy called Ulysses S. Grant. And many of you know who he is. You know, he became eventually the president elected after Lincoln, the one who replaced the son of a bitch Andrew Johnson that Lincoln selected as his vice president, who became president after he. Lincoln got deservedly shot in the head in 1865. So Ulysses S. Grant was the leader, eventually became the leader of the Union Army, and was the leader when the Union Army really took over and won the war. So he had this very brilliant guy under him, and he always butted heads with him. So because, see, when you have a principle and you have an idea and you know what is right. And you know that your superiors are getting in the way of what is right. You will, if you have principles in you, you will start fussing, making a fuss. So Ulysses S. Grant was making a fuss with Henry Halleck, and Henry Halleck just was very annoyed at Ulysses S. Grant because he was from a different mindset. This is the person that Lincoln put in there. This is the type of idiots that Lincoln put in there because. Lincoln was of that same mindset. He wanted to do things cautiously. He wanted to be aggressive enough to end the war quickly. In that sense, he was a little bit aggressive, but in general, in his philosophy was, I don't want to cause trouble. If I can win this war without freeing any slaves, let's leave it that way. You know, that cautious thinking. Instead of saying, no, let's eliminate the problem, let's get it over with and deal with it and take a risk in that sense. He wasn't like that. And that's why, in a sense, Henry Halleck was kind of the perfect person for the position that Fremont left vacant, what he was let go, because he was compatible, you know, spiritually, you could say, with Lincoln. But ironically, this is so ironic because Halleck, or well, I don't know if it's ironic, but it says a lot about Halleck. He wrote to Sherman at one point. He said, "I am simply, quote, a military advisor of the Secretary of War and the President, and must obey and carry out what they decide upon, whether I concur in their decisions or not. As a good soldier, I obey the orders of my superiors. If I disagree with them, I say so, but when they decide, it's my duty to faithfully carry out their decision." That was Henry Halleck's mindset. So this means that he had some disagreements with things that were being requested of him by Lincoln and the Secretary of War, who happened to be Edwin Stanton, that we've talked about also in previous audio snippets. But he said, "No, I'm not going to argue." And that's the way it's supposed to be in the military, this top-down mentality. I just obey the order of my superiors. And he said, "I do have the right to disagree, but if they decide it, it's my duty to faithfully carry out that decision." And there's a certain validity to that, but we'll try to talk about that a little bit later. But there's behind that apparent noble quote, there is a sinister reality there that we have to expose. Something very wrong with talking like that. And that exposes something very wrong with the military. Now, the other person we want to talk about is George McClellan, the guy who eventually became the Union Army leader after Winfield Scott. An incompetent in terms of what he produced. An incompetent son of a bitch, even though he was militarily very capable. He, because of the other things that were in him, he became a very incompetent leader of the Union Army. And he was the reason why the war went on so much longer than it really did. And McClellan was born in Philadelphia, so he was another northerner like Henry Halleck, but he was opposed to federal interference with slavery. So in other words, he sympathized with the South and their desire to preserve their slavery, and he thought that the federal government had nothing to do with that. It was not in their constitutional right to tell the states how to do things. Again, does that sound familiar or conservative? This is what George McClellan thought. And remember, if George McClellan had his way, there would have been no Civil War victory. We would have had two countries divided. And I think, for all intents and purposes, America as an entity would have been destroyed. We would have disintegrated. This country would have fallen apart, would have become a third world-esque type of mess, which is kind of what we're becoming now anyway. But the deterioration would have happened much more quickly. And so you, conservative, that mindset of yours would have destroyed this country. Ironically, you don't realize it. How you all said, "No, I love my country." Well, you love your country so much that you are, with your ideology, destroying it. Your thinking. That was the thinking that would have destroyed the country over 150 years ago if your ideology, your way of thinking had its way. And that's why I still find it so amazing that conservatives still see the problem as state rights not being respected by the evil federal government that's overstepping its boundaries. And they don't see the evil of federalism even now. They don't see it, and it's so saddening as the country is dying. As we've said, we only have 14 months left before the country officially is dead and there's nothing to fight for anymore. Now, This guy, because he was McClellan was kind of sympathizing with the South and their stance on state rights. Because of that, some of his Southern colleagues approached him informally about siding with the Confederacy, but he said, "No, I'm not going to do that," because he did not believe in the concept of secession. So just like he did not believe in the federal government enforcing the end of slavery on the sovereign states of the South, he also did not believe in secession. He wanted to preserve, quote, the Union. So that's why he didn't join the South. But he was sympathizing in his heart with the South. And you can see how what was inside this son of a bitch when he went to Virginia, in what is now West Virginia, that the part that separated from the state of Virginia because it didn't agree with Virginia and the South and the Confederacy. They wanted to stay with the Union, so they requested help, and the Union Army went into that part of Virginia and took it, you could say, because the people there were sympathetic to the Union Army. And that part eventually became the state of West Virginia. When he entered West Virginia, one of the first things he did when he entered there was he told everybody, "We're not here to free the slaves. In fact, we're here to help you protect your property. So if there's any there are any slaves out there who use our presence now here in this territory as an excuse to fight for their freedom or to try to get away from you and escape from you because they feel that they now have the freedom to do that because we're here, if that ever happens, let us know. We're gonna help you put those slaves in their place and help get them. If they try to get away, we will help catch them and give them back to you as your rightful property." That's what McClellan said to the people of West Virginia, the people who were trying to secede from Virginia, and many of whom were very anti-slavery. That was his thinking. So that's the type of son of a bitch that Lincoln chose as his Union Army leader because he was supposedly so brilliant. He apparently was this, as we said before, this genius in terms of the art of, I forget the term, but he was, he had this great knowledge of what was called the big war science. And he had a lot of railroad experience, so they thought because of that he would be perfect with a lot of military logistics, you know, handling the logistics that were needed to fight such a large-scale war as the Civil War was. So he was very brilliant militarily, but internally he was an excrement, a human excrement walking. This is the guy that Lincoln had. Now, but he stayed with the army, the Union Army, because he didn't believe in the concept of this separation of the country. He wanted to stay loyal to the principle of the country that he had sworn loyalty to, even though he was an outright defender of slavery, of that evil. And in fact, this guy, he was eventually demoted in a sense because he kept putting Lincoln down. Behind his back, McClellan would speak very ill, in a very bad way about Lincoln, calling him all sorts of things like a monkey, an inept person, you know, speaking behind his back constantly, even though, you know, when Lincoln showed up, he would kind of smile. But even so, his hatred of Lincoln became so deep that at one point Lincoln went to his house to talk to him about something. And as we explained before, McClellan made him wait. He was in his bedroom and made the president of the United States wait for 30 minutes. And after 30 minutes, he sent a maid or something to go tell Lincoln, "Hey, McClellan has gone to bed and he's not going to see you." So he made him wait 30 minutes, and then just told him, you know, to get the hell out of his house because he was going to sleep and was not going to deign to talk to him, go down and talk to him. That's kind of the arrogance. And Lincoln didn't immediately let him go. He still put up with him until eventually he gave up and chose somebody else. But that also shows you that, yes, you can be in a position. McClellan had a cause. His cause was let's fight for federalism. And even though he was a good, quote, soldier, and I say that in quotes, a good soldier, you know, staying in the army, following orders and so forth, the principle inside of him was just eating him up, and he started hating Lincoln for what he stood for. Not what he was, really was, but of what he stood for. What he stood for in the eyes of the South and everybody who was in favor of supporting slavery. And as we've talked about this before, that Lincoln had something over him that was not him, that was not part of him. And it was put over him by the prayers and the invocations of the people in this country who knew that slavery had to end. So Lincoln had an aura about him that was not him. And that's so important to understand. The same thing happens with Trump. Trump has an aura about him that makes him so hateable by the liberals. But it's not him totally. A lot of it is just what he represents, but not what he is. Because if they knew who he really is, they wouldn't hate him as much, because he is more compatible with them than they actually realize. So that was Lincoln as well. And McClellan started hating him profusely, to the point that he began to diss him, you know, treat him like that, and you don't do that to your superiors. But it gets to the point where if you disagree, because he believed in a cause, a wrong cause, but he believed it nonetheless, and it was just eating him up inside. And it gets to the point where you start acting out that rebellion against your quote superiors. So we've talked about these people a little bit, and now let's emphasize what we said before, that the Union Army was just fighting defense. They were trying to preserve the Union. So, you know, it's like a defensive back who in American football who is trying to keep the offensive player, the wide receiver, from catching the football. He's not there to gain yardage. He's there to prevent the other team gaining yardage. So it's always, this preserving of our position. So the Union Army had this constant defensive mindset, even though it was the one who was supposed to be on the offensive. It kept being defensive because it was under this idea that we are preserving the Union. They didn't understand that the Union had been lost, because the way that founding fathers set it up was that the states gave life to the Constitution. The moment the states seceded and said, we're not part of this anymore, the agreement was off. And they had the right to secede from the perspective of what the founding fathers left behind, conservatives. Pay attention. According to the founding fathers and the principles they laid out in the Constitution, the states, being sovereign, according to the 11th Amendment, had the power to eventually agree and say, we're not going to be part of this anymore, and secede. So from a legal perspective, and that's how bad the foundation was that the founding fathers left, based on the foundation they left, the southern states had the legal right to be a separate country and separate from the Union, because they gave life to the Constitution, not the other way around. So when the Union Army was fighting the South, they were not fighting rebel states that were betraying the country. They were fighting a separate nation. From a legal perspective, the Union Army was invading a foreign country. That's what it was doing. And that doesn't mean it was wrong. It's just, you have to understand, that's what we were doing. We were invading a foreign country, just like when the United States invaded Mexican territory and took all that territory away from Mexico. That, you know, can you imagine what a wasteland all of that territory would be if it had remained under Mexican control. How sad and pathetic, you know, California, Colorado, Nevada, and all these places. You know, they would have been like Tijuana, one big Tijuana, just horrible poverty, third world poverty, and so forth. So we rescued all that territory by taking it from Mexico. We invaded a foreign country and took their territory to fulfill the manifest destiny. And so we were doing kind of a similar thing with the South. And the Union Army didn't understand that. And on top of that, the Union Army was thinking, okay, we're here just to preserve the country. The slavery issue is not my problem. You know, just like, all these people that we've talked about who had this mindset, no, my concern is to preserve the Union, not to end slavery. So they were always on the defensive. And then when the Emancipation Proclamation came about, and we've talked about this, you know, how at the end of the day it was kind of an empty thing at the beginning, because Lincoln made sure that any place where the Emancipation Proclamation could have like a tangible, large-scale effect would be excluded from that, from the proclamation. It's so disheartening when you think about it. But aside from that, they'd issue the proclamation after 100 days of warning. It's like, oh, I'm going to do this, South. If you don't stop your rebellion, I'm going to do this. And then he eventually did it, the Emancipation Proclamation. And the moment that happened, without him realizing it, he energized the Union Army, because now the Union Army had a moral cause behind it and said, we're not just here to preserve the Union, playing defense. We're here on the attack. And we're here to take those sons of bitches and force them to give up slavery, and we're going to set the slaves free. And so they went, every time they fought, they were fighting for the freedom of the black people who were enslaved in those territories. Just like we fought to save the state of Nevada, the state of what is now the state of Nevada, or the territory of Colorado and the territory of California, from the oppression of Mexican domination. That's how the Union Army started fighting. We're going to fight for the freedom of slaves. And the slaves then are going to see us coming, and they're going to rebel. We can take them and put them in the army and give them weapons and fight. So that just completely re-energized the army, the Union Army, and the war effort. And all of this goes now to the heart of the military problem. And now we're going to get to it. The problem with the military in America, and I know this is a problem around the world, it's not just common to the American military, and it's a thing that's been in the history of the military throughout the human history. So, but I would dare say that something happened when America was born and began to develop its military. We took this principle, which was already a little bit crooked, and we kind of magnified it, and we gave it a level of methodology that empowered it and made it even more crooked. And the thing is that as we did that, because America was always kind of the shining example to the rest of the world, it has always been. Yeah, it's 14 months away from not being that anymore, but we have been the shining example that everybody else tries to imitate. Then the problems that we began to exacerbate in the military system began to be emulated by other countries. And other countries follow a lot of kind of the principles, military principles that America has established. And the problem that we want to talk about is this idea that in the American military, there's this kind of subtle promotion of the abuse of inferiors. And I say this in quotes, quote, inferiors by, quote, superiors, in order to break their spirit and make them completely submissive. You know, we all know the stories about the angry shouting sergeant who is forcing people to do things and shouting at the ranked soldiers and telling them, do this, do that, the other, and then out of nowhere, the sergeant goes, do 100 push-ups, and for no reason at all. And the guy has to do it, or the sergeant says to the soldier, spit on the ground, and then go, get down on the ground and suck the spit back into your mouth. And the soldier, you know, he has to do it because his superior is telling him to do it. So, and there's a lot of hazing going on, as you may know, in the military. So there's this culture of abusing inferiors, people in a quote inferior position. And why is it allowed? Why is it tolerated? Why is it promoted? You know, where the inferior person has to do whatever the superior person tells him or her, whether it makes sense or not, whether it's the right thing to do. If it's an arbitrary thing, they just go ahead and do it. And why is that attitude in there? Why is it supported or promoted in a subtle way? Because it's been justified as a way to break the spirit of the soldier and make sure that he is completely submissive to his superiors, so that at the time of war, when he's told to do something, he's going to do it and not think twice about it. And that is to promote military efficiency. See, the American spirit has always been the spirit of practical efficiency. And that has helped a lot in many practical ways, but at the same time, it has been one of the Achilles heels of the American culture, this excessive practicality. So it's a way to make the army more efficient. So the American military has instituted these concepts or subtle ideas into the culture that promote this arbitrary abuse of inferiors to force them to break their will, to break their spirit, to turn them into robots that just do what they're told, so that they can be more, quote, efficient soldiers. And then you get told over and over again, you obey your commanders. There's this promotion, this teaching of unconditional obedience to your superiors. And as that is done, what the army begins to do is to destroy the individuality of the soldier. And the bad thing is, once you start doing that, even though that turns them into a very efficient robot, it also creates an emotional dependence on the collective group. And that's why you see, like, with the Marines, like, hoorah, and all these people, that they start developing this kind of brotherhood with their fellow soldiers. And yes, that's wonderful and all that, but it becomes kind of very unhealthy, very, very, very psychologically unhealthy, this great dependence on the collective. So because their individuality has been broken and destroyed, then their sense of identity is tied to the group, to the collective. And they feel like when they're not part of the group, then they are nothing. And the whole loyalty becomes the group. I'm a Marine, you know, Semper Fi and blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, I'm from the military or from the Navy. This sort of thing, like my identity is tied to the group because they have already lost their own individuality. And that causes a lot of problems, because once they break away from the military, you know, they come back from war or whatever, a lot of them have all this all these psychological breakdowns, and it's because, you know, they are kind of separated from that which gives them a sense of identity, a purpose in life, because their individuality was systematically destroyed. And on top of that, you know, when they come back home from having fought in Afghanistan or Vietnam or Iraq or wherever they were sent, the problem is that they, a lot of times, you know, they had to do very horrible things or fight or kind of live out very horrible things. And then it starts plaguing their conscience, because they were doing it not because it was the right thing to do, the necessary thing to do, but because they were being told, because their individuality is destroyed. So now they become just these robots who just execute the order and do what they're told. And when that happens, then when they get back home, then guilt starts attacking them, because they don't understand the more moral underpinnings of what they had to do if they did the right thing. And then they start getting tormented by it, because once they're detached from the military, from that which kind of gave them this sense of, I'm not going to worry about this, you know, like, I'm not going to worry about the moral ramifications of what I'm doing or not doing. That's completely a separate topic. I'm just going to do what I'm told. So while they're in the army, they have this kind of psychological umbrella over them that helps them to sleep at night because they're just doing what they're told. But when they get out of the army, of the military, and go back home, and they no longer have that umbrella, then a lot of the things they had to do start to haunt them. And that's why they get into PTSD and all this other stuff, because now they have to fight this battle inside of justifying what they did. But because they don't have the tools in their head, in their minds, in their hearts to do the justification, then they start getting tormented by what happened, and then they go into depression and all these other things, and all these horrible psychological effects of these soldiers who have left the military because of this problem, that their individuality was destroyed by this constant systematic destroying of their individual will, forcing them to unconditionally submit to whatever they're told to do. And that is the root problem in the military. As I've said, this has kind of always been the case throughout history, but it's as if at some point we kind of, in America, took it to a next level because we kind of systematized it. We kind of put it into books, in a sense, and made a systematic destroying of the individual value of every soldier to turn them into efficient robots. And then the rest of the world has copied us. So in other words, it's like we have our West Point, who has kind of produced a system of the destruction of individuality and kind of evangelized the rest of the world into a kind of embracing the same concept. And different countries at, you know, at different levels have embraced that mindset because we have made it the official thing to do in a way that had never been done before. And speaking of West Point, there was a story recently, and I know this is not a coincidence as we've been talking about this. There was a story recently that came out about how the cadets at West Point, who had been kind of filing religious exemption requests to not take the mRNA injection against the we've talked about the injection before, but so in the military, they've been forced to take the injection. And again, because of this thing of unconditional submission, they're not supposed to question it. They're not supposed to say, oh, you don't have the right to destroy my body like that. And most of the military have embraced it. But a few brave ones have said, no, I can't do that. And then they were given like the out clause or option, exit option of the religious exemption. So a lot of them took it and said, oh, for religious reasons, I don't want to take the injection. And the story was about them being always denied. Like they were immediately denied. All these religious exemptions were just, it was just procedure. But it was just to kind of make it official that it was in the protocol, but these requests were just being automatically denied, and the thing is they would be denied very quickly and be told, okay, you have to comply in 2 days. In 2 days, you have to tell us when you're going to take the shot and this and that and the other, or otherwise you're going to be discharged. And they were being told, if you get discharged, this is going to go on your record. And then people outside in the civil, society are going to find out that you were dishonorably discharged, and this is going to affect you the rest of your life. So they started kind of harassing and intimidating them into saying your life will be destroyed. Even if you leave the army, the military, and go live your private civilian life, your life is destroyed if you don't obey us right now. So they started intimidating them, and a lot of them would just yield. And speaking of the religious exemption, I'm not going to say this is the rule, and every case is different. Every person will have to decide separately because I don't think I feel I there, I can I don't feel the freedom to say something at a more universal level, but I must speak from my own perspective that I would never use a religious exemption as a justification for not taking the injection, because it's not that I personally wouldn't do it because like I'm not doing it because it's not it's in the Bible that thou shalt not be injected with a vaccine, you know. Like now, you know, maybe if you're a Jehovah's Witness, they have like different sets of rules and they can use that. But if you're a Christian, you can't go to the say the Bible says that. So it's not a the religious exemption is kind of like a legal out that some people use. But I would never use it because it's like saying, oh, you know, that sounds like when you're a kid and some friends come and tell you, hey, let's come out and play. Let's go. We're gonna go play this game somewhere. Get out of the house and come with us. And you go, oh, I can't go out because my parents won't let me go out. I have to do my homework, and they've told me that if I don't do my homework first, they're gonna ground me and this and that, and therefore I really can't go. And they've told me not to play with you guys because you it's you're too rough and it's too dangerous to play with you. So I want to play with you, but my parents won't let me out. So you know, the kids go away all sad because they couldn't get the kid to leave the house and play with them. And the kid stays, you know, looking out the window, all sad, because he wishes he could join them, but he can't because his parents are forcing him to stay home. That's kind of what the religious exemption sounds like to me. Like I'm saying, oh, I would love to get injected. Oh, really? I'd like to be with everybody else and join the crowd and be part of the group and all that. But you know, my religion, you know, my parents, my religion is telling me that I can't do it. So I'm really, 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 really sorry. I wish I could, but my religion is preventing me doing it. You know, and so to me personally, and I'm not saying this applies to everybody, so in some cases that might be the perfect legal excuse to just get around the problem. But I always saw this religious exemption thing as a trap. It was never really meant to be. It's just there for legal purposes, but it's really not. The liberals never meant it as a legitimate out. A real justification. And if you're a Muslim, then I guess then the religious exemption takes hold. Or if you're from this exotic African voodoo religion, then yes, then okay, religious exemption granted. But if you're a Christian, especially a conservative Christian, hell no. So it was always a silly excuse, and to take that seemed like playing along and falling for their game. So no, if you're against the injection, you're against the injection because it's scientifically wrong to take this mRNA gene therapy injection that is called a vaccine, and it's really not a vaccine. To the point that they had to change the definition of what a vaccine was to make it a quote vaccine. And we know it's killing people. All these people who are dying suddenly. I saw this article about. From the a new a website, you know, the Telegraph or one of those, talking about all these people who are dying, all the deaths that are happening in the UK. The funeral homes can't keep up. There's a long waiting period for people to bury their dead because there's so many dying. And I was reading the article, and it's so sad because they were talking. The experts say that it must be the consequence of all the diseases that were not taken care of during the pandemic, because we were so focused on fighting the Wuhan flu virus. I mean, they don't call them that. They don't call it that, but that's what I call it, the Wuhan flu virus. So they come up with all these excuses to justify. They know people are dying in mass, and we all know why they're dying in mass. We all know deep inside, we all know they're dying because this injection is just devastating people's cardiac health and their immune system, all these diseases that are coming back because this injection is reviving these diseases that we had defeated before, because it's destroying the immune system. So it is scientifically invalid. It is morally wrong to impose this poison on people. So if I'm going to oppose it, I oppose it on the grounds of that your injection is evil. So it's like the kids coming to, they say, come out of the house, but they want me to come out of the house to go vandalize some neighbor a few blocks down. They are going to, paint his car and do all sorts of poke the guy's tires and break some windows and do all this vandalism because, let's say, the guy's away on a trip and they want to take advantage of that to vandalize his house. And it's like the kids coming to me to my house and say, hey, come out and let's go vandalize this neighbor's house. And me saying, hey, I wouldn't say no. I wish I could go vandalize the house, but my parents won't let me. I have to do my homework. That's, to me, the religious exemption. I would go, no. I don't care what my parents think. I'm not going to do that. Even if my parents would let me out or not let me out, if I could come out right now, I wouldn't, because I'm not going to go vandalize that neighbor's house with you. So that's the stance that needs to be taken. But the people at West Point, and because they have these cadets and this indoctrination. So this thing that the conservatives blame the liberals about, this constant imposition of things. The liberals are the real fascists, the ones who are constantly imposing their ideology on people over and over and over again against their will. You are going to like homosexuality, and we're going to shove it down your throat until you say it's okay. We're going to shove transsexuality, transvestite behavior on you until you think it's okay, and we're going to shove it in your face. We could be talking about football, and we're going to shove transsexuality in your face to force you to comply. We could be talking about food or anything else, but we're going to change the topic and force you to accept this. And if you don't like this, you're going to be ostracized and vilified, and you're going to be labeled this, that, the other. This constant imposition of ideology all the time. That is in the military. Ironically, and a lot of these people who are conservatives in the military, they have accepted that way of thinking within the military realm. The same thinking that they condemn from liberals. But it's internal. And when West Point was doing this thing with the cadets, saying, okay, you're going to submit, you're going to take the injection, and we're going to destroy your life if you don't, because you are supposed to obey us unconditionally. This leads to a suppression of one's sense of morality. And that's also what, as we said before, leads to guilt later on. So if you're a soldier in Afghanistan, you had to kill a whole bunch of people because they were, terrorists, or you saw all this evil being done by the terrorists. But, in Iraq, for example, all the terrorists would do all this evil damage, these terrorist attacks, and kill civilians in the process. And if you're at home, you have left Iraq and you're at home thinking about all the carnage, and then you start hearing people saying, hey, if you had not gone to Iraq, none of that would have happened. These terrorists were fighting, were there because you were there. And then you start feeling a sense of guilt. And you go, oh my goodness, yes. And because your sense of morality has been destroyed, you were just there obey. You stopped thinking about what was right, what was wrong. You just did it because you were told. Then once your morality comes back, in a sense, starts coming back, then you don't know what to do, and it leads to guilt. But if you had understood, we had to be in Iraq, and you understood the principles behind it, why we were there, and how none of all this carnage was our fault. It was the terrorists who were trying to destroy democracy. They were trying to destabilize the country because they hated that Iraq was about to become a country of free democratic people who could live their lives in freedom, and they wanted to destroy that. Now, if you understand that in principle, then your guilt is not going to be there, because you're going to realize you were fighting a just war. You were, and you as a soldier were doing these things you had to do, not because your superiors were telling you to do, but because your principles were saying this is the right thing to do. And that's what's not in the military. And this problem that the military has has also plagued the American police system in a way that it hasn't in other countries. To a certain extent it has, but not the way it has in America. If you look at the American police system, the police in America behave a lot like the military. Unlike other countries in the world, if you look at them, they all have this thing about you follow orders, you follow protocol, you follow procedure. They behave like soldiers in many ways. You know, they stand before their superior and they do the salute, and everything is very formal. If you look at the police funerals and all that, it's all like the military. They have the same mindset of the police in America in a way that's not the case in any other country on earth, I personally believe. Is an extension of the military, and you can see that that same spirit plaguing the police, and that's why the police in America tend to be much more brutal and much more harsh than in other countries, because they are in military mode. Then when they go out to serve the public, the public become like a soldier or police officer of an inferior rank, if you know what I mean. Like, so if they say, hey, you do this, and if you disagree, hey, why am I doing this? Then they take the attitude with you and go, no, you do this or we're gonna arrest you right now, because you do what you're told. Like, or as you've seen on television many times, where a police officer comes to a person and starts asking questions. Like, you give me the answer that I want right now, and the person starts asking questions in return, and the police officer goes, I'm the one asking the questions here, and because they are in military mode, and you, the public, are just a person who is of lower rank, who is before a person of authority, and you just have to obey whatever they are telling you to do without questioning. So he asks you a question, you answer it. Full stop. End of story. You don't ask why you're asking the question. You just answer it because you have to do what you're told. So that's what leads then to the brutality, you could say, or the police coming off as brutes in America. And I have to say that one of the police forces that has fought to kind of end that has been the New York police force. And the New York police force is messed up right now because of the mayors that they have had there and all that. But that's a separate story. But in general, the New York Police Department was one of the first departments to really begin to focus on, you know, we are here to protect and serve. And that's why all the police cars, during the Giuliani era, I think, I'm not sure if that was when it happened, but they began to put CPR in all their police cars. Courtesy, professionalism, respect. So it's like saying, we're here to fight for law and order, but we're here to protect the public. So if I am a member of the public and I am not a criminal, you police officer, they understood that they as police officers were to treat me with respect and with courtesy, because as a member of the non-criminal element of society, I am the one that they are supposed to serve, not the other way around. I'm not here to serve the police officer. The police officer is here to serve me. Now, if I'm doing criminal stuff, then yes, then the police officer can tell me what to do and lock me up and do whatever. But if I am a law-abiding citizen, then I am his master. And the New York Police Department kind of began to embrace that concept in ways that other departments had not. And that's what leads to the conflict with black people, because black people who are in a culture where they have no father figure, They never get told what to do. I mean, you look at black people, a lot of them are raised with this attitude that you don't tell them what to do, because if you tell them what to do, you're going to get in trouble with them. And it's part of that visionary personality that we've talked about before, when it's out of control, it's like a rebel without a cause kind of thing. So when the police officer comes, and they come with this heavy-handed attitude to begin with, and they might be justified, but they come with this heavy-handed attitude to begin with, and that collides with this completely rebellious attitude that rebels for the sake of rebelling. Like, you don't tell me what to do. Because, and that's the combination of the visionary conqueror qualities of in black people, gone awry. And then you have the clash, and that's why you have black people and the police always kind of at each other's throats all the time. And that doesn't justify how black people, kind of blame everything on police brutality, but there is an element of that, because I have experienced that. I have seen it when I have been treated like dirt, when I've not done anything wrong. And especially in the New York area, Hispanic police officers tend to do that, because it comes from the Hispanic culture, where in the Hispanic culture, if you become empowered, they feel that that gives them the power to step on other people. It's a very evil culture of opportunism in a very bad way. So whenever they gain a position of authority, they like to impose it on people, especially when they see someone who doesn't look white, or that they feel a need to respect. If they see somebody who looks a little bit like them, or who has brown skin or whatever, they think, oh, I can tell him what to do, and now is the perfect moment to do it. So I've had a lot of that with police people of Hispanic descent, but I've also had it with white people, white police officers, even though they tend to be a lot more respectful at the end of the day than Hispanic police officers. But the thing is, I've experienced that, so I know there's a heavy-handedness there, and it comes from this issue with the military that we've been talking about, because the American police system is an extension of the American military. So in a sense, the military has kind of become like a prison, and it becomes like a prison where you lose your rights, because when you go to prison, you don't have the right to privacy. You can't say, oh, I have a right to my private space. No. All your letters are going to be read by someone before they're given to you. The envelopes are going to be opened. All the packages are going to be opened, because obviously they can't just let any package go through, because it might have weapons or drugs or whatever. So they have to inspect it. So all your privacy's gone, and your right to life, in the sense of your right to a freedom of movement, all of that is limited. Why? Because you violated someone else's rights. So now you lose your own rights, and you're sent to prison. And in a sense, the military has kind of become that, because when you go there, you lose your rights. You surrender a lot of rights, and even your constitutional rights are suppressed, and you become part of a different legal system. And that's why in the military they have the court martials, like a completely separate judicial system, separate from the judicial system of civilians. And you might say there's a practical reason for that, especially in times of war, but we have that even in peacetime, where a soldier cannot say, oh, my superior is violating my human rights. Because no, once you enter the military, it's like you're in prison. And if the warden tells you to do this, you're going to do it, whether you like it or not. And they can't go to the, they can't file a lawsuit against their superior or anything like that, because once you enter the military, it's like you go into a prison system, and you lose your rights, and that is wrong. It is wrong to give the military a separate judicial system, because then it just says to the military, you can abuse these people all you want. We're not really gonna get, unless you do something very egregious, we're not going to get involved. You treat them like dirt, like scum, because I know you need to do that to train them to be submissive robots. So we have handed over these people, and the sad thing is then these people are sent to fight for freedom. So we deny them, we oppress them in a system that is completely the opposite of freedom, and then tell them to fight freedom for freedom, and then we are surprised that they have all these psychological conflicts afterwards. I hope you're making sense with what I'm saying here. And all of that has to stop. And because, you know, the people in the military are forced to tolerate things that would never be tolerated anywhere else. Now, I understand that it's hard to be a soldier. You know, you have to go fight a war and see horrible things and do these gruesome things that no one else is being asked to do. But it should be like part of the job, not something that you're forced to do. If you know what I mean, is where you have lost you detach yourself from reality and you become this robot that just obeys orders. So all of this has to be changed. But then the question becomes, what do we do then? Because we just can't have people in the military just saying, you know, doing whatever they want. And by the way, it's important to point out all of this because as I've said before, if the military had a different attitude, they would have not embraced the injections as we did. If we had a different attitude, they would not have just accepted Joe Biden's electoral fraud standing up. You know, right now the military is being destroyed from within. You have all these. There's a high ranking military officer who is a transvestite. He's a man dressed as a woman. He shows up. It's so embarrassing and ridiculous in the pictures. You know, the guy dressed like a woman, and it's not a joke. And he's a high ranking officer, and now you know, transsexuality and all this other stuff is being promoted in the military, being forced on them, and because they have to submit, they just have all this. And I think it's part of the degradation to force America to realize what's wrong with the whole system, including the military. And the people in the military are it's like the whole system is being allowed to collapse so that the military and everybody realizes that we're doing something wrong. But the military has continued to remain submissive. And most of them are accepting the injections, and they're suffering the consequences. The military is being totally kind of maybe it's not destroyed, but it's being greatly affected by all the people who are getting sick and injured from these injections. But if they had a different attitude, they would have said, hell no, we're not going to serve under a fraud. We're not going to serve under the system that's imposing these things that are killing me and killing other people willy-nilly. If they had just said, no, we're quitting, and there would have been this massive, massive quitting in the military, and that would have had a ripple effect on all of society, and society would have said, well, what's going on here? And we would have been forced to examine what's happening, but the military didn't have the courage to do that because, you know, you just do what you're told. They tell you to take the injection, you do it. The sergeant tells you to spit on the ground and then get down on your knees and suck the spit back into your mouth. You do it because you do what you're told. And because the military continued with that attitude, it's being self-destroyed, literally right now. So how do you deal with all of this? How do you deal with the importance of everyone following the plan in order to succeed? In other words, you need people who obey the plan for the plan to work. Because if you have a plan, we're going to do this, this, and this, and attack the enemy here and there, and everybody says, oh, but I have an opinion here. I don't think we should do this, and I'm not going to do it because I don't agree with the plan. If you have everybody just thinking on their own like that, then I understand there's going to be chaos, and who's going to win a war like that? So there's this conflict. How do you deal with one thing without losing the other? And what you do is you change the strategy from brute force enforcement to evangelism about the plan and the mission. In other words, you teach people, we are in Iraq because of this. We're fighting for democracy. We're fighting so that there's a place where terrorism is not, there's no nest of terrorism that will do damage. Even if they don't attack America, they're doing damage to a lot of people all over the world, and we can't go for that. So when you start teaching, we're doing this out of this principle. We're not doing this out of just self-interest. And that's what conservatism is all about, self-interest. And that's why they don't like wars, and everybody who, they always like to use the term warmonger, warmonger. If you go to the conservative websites, that's the term they use, warmonger. The Democrats are warmongers. They liked war. They want war in Ukraine. They want war here, there, because they hate fighting a war where they don't see a tangible benefit to the country. And these idiots, conservative idiots, including the idiot Trump, they don't realize that if we hadn't fought in Iraq, the country would be dead by now, for reasons too long to explain here. But that's what has kept the hope of this country not dying alive. And on top of that, the war in Iraq, even though you know, it's been bungled and now undermined by Democrats, opened a door that will, a door of opportunity, of blessing to the Middle East, that may hopefully be manifested many years down the road. But we did something for the Middle East and the world when we fought that war in Iraq and took down Saddam Hussein. And also, we saved ourselves from terrorist attacks that would have happened had Iraq become, had Iraq stayed under the oppression of Saddam Hussein. So we win, we reap this harvest, but it's almost intangible. You do what's right, and then good things will happen to you as a consequence. You know, people call it karma, whatever you want to call it. But if you do the right thing, then you sow righteousness, and you're going to reap righteousness. And we have been blessed by having fought the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Sadly, by the senile bastard in the White House is he poo-pooed on everything, and now Afghanistan has turned into this hellhole again. They are oppressing people, doing all these horrible things right now. The Taliban is back in power there. The thing is that there was a reason for us being there. This audio snippet's gone on for very long. We'll continue talking about this in the next audio snippet. But I hope that this has more or less begun to give you a sense of what we need to change in the military. Because we've turned the military into a slave plantation. So in a sense, it is tied to slavery and Black America at the end of the day. And that's why we're talking about it right now. So we'll continue talking about it later, and we'll then move on to the rest of Lincoln and what happened during Reconstruction and all of that in a future audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.